Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The 19th Amendment, enshrining a woman's right to vote, was ratified in August of 1920. But did you know that a century earlier, for a brief period of time, women voted alongside men in New Jersey? Why did it end? It's a fascinating story. We'll have more in just a bit. Also, at NJGov is not your typical government Twitter feed. Two New Jersey women have infused the state government's Twitter account with some Jersey girl sass and fun. But first, we welcome Philadelphia City Council President Daryl Clark back to Radio Times. We have a number of important issues to discuss, including an update on the coronavirus in our area and the city's preparedness. Also, Philadelphia has long been called the poorest big city in America, and so City Council is proposing a poverty action plan whose goal would be to help at least 100,000 Philadelphians emerge from poverty over the next 4 years. The plan would include a basic income stipend for all Philadelphians. Daryl Clark, good to have you with us once again.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Let's start with the coronavirus. As of today, there are no confirmed cases in Philly, correct?
Correct.
Although we do have some presumptive cases in Montgomery County, at least one in Camden County in New Jersey. You know, the general consensus is it will eventually show up here in Philly. So is the city adequately prepared, in your opinion?
Yeah, well, we had a significant briefing by Dr. Farley, and he's in constant contact with representatives from the CDC and the state. And the reality is that we're trying to ensure that people follow the science. That's the most important aspect of it, not get caught up in the rhetoric and from people that frankly don't know what's really going on or what you should anticipate may happen. Common sense things such as wash your hands. You don't necessarily have to find Purell, which is very difficult to find right now in today's shelves in all your stores across the city. But just wash your hands and be careful about touching. They are recommending for individuals of certain ages not to be in large groups of people. We do have to have some conversations about some of the larger events in the city of Philadelphia. We have a couple plans, so we're thinking through that now. But the reality is that while you want to create a sense of urgency to a degree of people trying to and listening to the scientists, the people that really know about this, you still want to be able to have people have the quality of life that they're used to.
Sure.
So there's a thin line between creating a panic, which we clearly should not be in a position to do, but you do want to make sure that people pay attention to what people are telling you to do. So I'm confident that the people in charge in the city of Philadelphia have a clear sense of what you should do. They are briefing us on a consistent basis. We're taking some measures in some of the public buildings where you have a lot of individuals in and out of that. So you'll see that over the next several days. But, you know, I'm confident in the people that we have in charge today.
So exercise caution, but no panic.
Please do not panic. That can drive not only individuals getting a little bit beyond what they need to be doing and creating some levels of, and let's call it like it is, some economic despair. I know you shouldn't be talking about the economics, but the simple reality is if you close down a particular facility, that will have some impact on the individual. The individuals, everybody in the city of Philadelphia doesn't necessarily have paid sick leave, unfortunately. They may not have the ability to have child care. They may not have the ability to deal with some of the challenges associated with being out of work. So we don't want to create a panic. We just want people to be cautious and follow the science.
One more quick question before we move on to the poverty action plan. You know, many cases are mild, but it can be especially deadly to the elderly. At least, you know, 16 deaths now in this nursing home near Seattle. So, Daryl Clark, is this one facet of the illness in which the city needs to focus on preventive action for, you know, facilities in which there are elderly, nursing care facilities, assisted living facilities?
Well, there is a plan in place for those high probability facilities across the city of Philadelphia. They're talking about age categories of people that should be concerned. They're saying if you're above 60, there is a more of a probability that you may be subject to contracting the virus. It's about underlying health issues and all of the things associated with that. So hopefully everybody is taking the appropriate precautions for individuals that could possibly be in some risk.
Okay, I can see you're having some difficulty with your headphones, so why don't you just take them off and you can put them on the table, and I'm sure we'll be able to have our conversation.
There you go.
And do do well with it. So let's go on to Philadelphia City Council's Poverty Action Plan. About a quarter of all Philadelphians struggle with poverty.
Yeah.
What are some of the highlights, Darrell Clark, of the new plan?
Well, as you said, it's to some degree, it's unbelievable, but literally one out of every four Philadelphians are living at or below the level of poverty. And that's mind-blowing in some respects, because the level of poverty as it relates to a working wage, you're literally under $8 an hour.
And it's an entrenched problem. It has been, officials have tried for years to
generational.
Tackle this.
When we did the research to put together this document, we found that Philadelphia was up in the upper echelon of those cities that were in poverty for decades. We went all the way back to the 70s, and we were always up at the top level, which caused some people to believe that there's nothing that we can do about that. But, you know, we're optimistic. We're the glass half full kind of people, and we believe that this is achievable. So what we've done, we've talked about identifying the quote-unquote low-hanging fruit. And believe it or not, there's a significant level of low-hanging fruit. Did you know, in the city of Philadelphia, $450 million in benefits that are paid for by both state, federal, and local municipalities are available to people every year that we don't take advantage of?
Really?
Unbelievable. $450 million.
So this is where the one form for all comes in?
We talk about one form for all. There's no reason that you should have to fill out multiple forms and sometimes trying to get through either in a line at a facility or online or trying to go to a local office where you can get access to this. Makes no sense in today's world. So you should be able to apply for every particular benefit associated with your household, with your utilities, all the things that are due you on the local level. The simple reality is that the Earned Income Tax Credit, as an example, a federal benefit, where if you fill out that Earned Income Tax Credit, you literally can get up to $6,000, $6,000 of federal dollars that will go as a result of you being a working individual that is low income and filling out that simple form. We've done a little better over the last year or two. We've gotten that number down, but right now we're anticipating there are 40,000 households that don't have the ability to get that particular tax credit. So we're on top of that. We want to aggressively seek that.
So the plan also proposes a basic income policy, which has been tried in a handful of cities, including Stockton, California. Darrell Clark, how would this work in Philly to mitigate poverty? What is your vision?
Yeah, so the one thing that I like about this particular plan is that we talked to everybody prior to us implementing this and prior to us putting this package together. And we realized that the city of Philadelphia doesn't necessarily do everything well. And one of the things that we realized is that the United Way, one of our foremost nonprofit entities in the city, has actually put forth a proposal for basic income. And what they would like us to do is to essentially identify some resources from the municipality or other parts of government and have leverage from the private sector. We found out that there are a significant number of private sector companies and individuals that would like to contribute to their basic income.
So when you're saying basic income, who are we talking about? Who would receive it and approximately how much? Do you have a figure?
Yeah.
Ballpark?
Well, we're waiting for the exact dollar amount. One of the concerns that we have that in that number, that 400,000 a number that's attached to Philadelphia's poverty rate, there are a number of people that are on fixed incomes, people that are disabled, people coming out of a correctional facility that the likelihood of them getting a job immediately is somewhat challenging for them. Those people need to have some level of basic income coming out. So while there will be some municipal investment, some government investment, we're looking at a significant level of private investment. We found that people in the corporate community are willing to participate, particularly the fact that it's the United Way. So I'm excited about that. We're going to be laying out a very detailed plan on that particular proposal very shortly.
Universal basic income is a fairly progressive policy. Darrell Clark, what sort of support are you finding among your fellow council members?
Actually, a lot. One of the things that we did also is that We included everybody. We were at a recent press conference when we were rolling this initiative out, and one of the reporters asked, well, it's been tried before. They had this initiative called Shared Prosperity, and it didn't work. I said, well, you know, it didn't work, but it was good intentions. The one thing we recognize is that early on in the process, you should include everybody, not just elected officials, right? Not just appointed officials, but you should go out in the neighborhoods and get everyone's perspective. We did that. We had hearings all the way across the city. We had individuals coming in that had been working on initiatives because, lo and behold, we found that there are a lot of people that are working on poverty plans, but they're in their silos. So we got everybody on board. People felt good about the fact that we're consolidating ideas, consolidating strategies, and we think this particular action plan is going to be significant.
Mayor Kenney proposed a budget of just over $5 billion last week. He says he shares the goal of lifting 100,000 Philadelphians out of poverty. Where do the administration's anti-poverty initiatives dovetail with the council plan, and where do they part ways?
Yeah, well, I think the most significant aspect of the plan that intersects with the poverty action rollout, and we had members of the mayor's team as a part of this commission that worked on this particular study, so you'll see a lot of similarities. The educational component, adult education, is so important because a significant number of these individuals, the 100,000 that are in the working poverty category, heads of household, if they were in a position to get some additional educational support to take advantage of jobs that are being created in the city of Philadelphia, we think easily you can move those people out of poverty. As an example, right now a poverty wage is just below $8 an hour. We believe that if you move those individuals up to $10 an hour, you not only would move those individuals out of a poverty wage, you would generate more than $400 million in new revenue for those individuals.
This is something that might have to be resolved in Harrisburg, though, too, right? Raising the minimum wage?
Well, not necessarily, because you're seeing a movement towards individuals that are going to the $15, $12, the number that we've been looking at, a working wage, so to speak, a living wage. So we anticipate that we'll be in a position. The city set an example that anyone having a contract with the city of Philadelphia must pay those workers for that particular company $12 an hour. And we're setting an example. We're seeing a significant level of interest from the private sector on the stage at our Poverty Action Rollout Plan. We had the head of the Chamber of Commerce, and he said he was fully committed, and I love that, right? We had also individuals from the various significant universities around the city of Philadelphia. They are on board with this, so I'm excited about the level of participation, and we're going to get this done. I'm telling you, it's going to happen.
All right, well, we only have about 15 seconds left.
That's okay.
Why might this new plan move the needle on poverty where others have failed?
The stars have aligned. I like to say that years ago, people decided that we were going to go to the moon. Right now, we've decided that we're going to solve this poverty problem. And just like they did when they went to the moon, the city of Philadelphia is going to take 100,000 people, move them out of poverty by 2024.
All right, we'll be in touch. Philadelphia City Council President Daryl Clark, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
And in just a moment or so on Radio Times, women were given the right to vote in New Jersey upon the signing of the Declaration of Independence, but it was taken away a few decades later. We'll hear that story coming up. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. It's a little known fact that in the early days of our country, some women enjoyed the right to vote a full century before the ratification of the 19th Amendment, albeit briefly, and it happened in New Jersey. Women and certain people of color cast ballots alongside white men of property in New Jersey around the time of the Revolutionary War and for a few decades afterwards. And then their right to vote disappeared. The Museum of the American Revolution is crafting an exhibit which explores this period in New Jersey's history called When Women Lost the Vote, A Revolutionary Story, 1776 to 1807. And joining us now to discuss the research process and what they've discovered so far are Philip Mead, Chief Historian and Director of Curatorial Affairs for the Museum of the American Revolution. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Marcella Micucci is Curatorial Fellow in Women's History for the Museum. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you both here. So who was Sarah Van Dyke? Let's start by talking about her story. Marcella?
Yeah, that's actually a very specific story. And actually, I'm going to backtrack just a moment just to give you a little bit of contextual background.
Okay.
So part of what we've been doing here at the museum has been uncovering some of these poll lists for voters in New Jersey generally, but specifically being able to identify women voters on those lists. And we have been able to identify 9 lists that actually do include the names of women voters, which is very exciting for us.
Why did you suspect there might be women's names on these poll lists, which, what, dated back to around the time of the Revolutionary War or just afterwards?
So under the New Jersey State Constitution from 1776 to something that will eventually be overturned in 1807, the election law is left kind of intentionally vague. So there's no racial or gender qualifications in the election law of the New Jersey State Constitution, which leaves the electorate open to women and free people of color, as long as they can meet the property qualification. So there has been a lot of anecdotal evidence in history, primarily things like newspaper accounts that speak to women voters in this earlier period in New Jersey. But there's actually very little primary evidence on poll lists of women actually voting. So we kind of took it upon ourselves to go out into the archives and kind of mine these historical resources, you know, get down and dirty into the archives and really pull out some of this. And we were very fortunate to be able to have found some lists that actually do identify women voters.
So before we move on with the story, what does of property mean? How much did you have to be worth, to be blunt about it, to be able to head to the polls?
Sure. Well, while there is no gender or racial requirement for the electorate in the electoral clause of the New Jersey Constitution, there is a property requirement. And it says somewhat arcanely, you must be worth 50 pounds proclamation money.
What is proclamation money?
Well, we spent a lot of time trying to figure that out. Proclamation money was a term derived from the beginnings of New Jersey as a separate colony under Queen Anne, and it essentially means transferable currency. New Jersey had several issues of currency in the 1770s through the 1790s that were issued in the form of pounds as opposed to dollars, which became the American system later in the federal period. But they continued to use the term proclamation money to define who can vote well into the period past the nation and the state has adopted dollars as the mode of exchange. However, they did specify that taxes would be assessed in pounds. And so we thought, okay, we'll go to the tax ratables, and that'll give us a picture of who can vote. But that really didn't work out very well for us as researchers. The tax ratables are not designed in the period to identify who is and who isn't worth 50 pounds.
Off to the poll lists then.
Well, the poll lists, just that's a whole other thing. It appears that no one is enforcing the property requirement, except when someone goes to the poll, if there's doubts about their eligibility, they could ask to swear an oath that they are worth 50 pounds. And then in 1807, when they overturn, they change the law to make it, they say, just white men worth 50 pounds proclamation money. They then say, anyone who pays taxes, we say, is worth 50 pounds. And that's how they resolve the problem.
So before we get to that piece of the story, let's go back a little bit to the search for these poll lists. And Marcella, do you remember when you first spotted a woman's name on the poll lists and what went through your mind?
I absolutely remember. It was one of the better days of work, I think, for me. Phil retells the story of me actually finally getting in touch with the archivist at the New Jersey State Archives, who, you know, knew that they had some women voters on their list and sent them over, you know, a photocopied scan of a list from Montgomery Township in Somerset County.
Which is right near Princeton, right?
It's very close, yeah. Yep, for an election in October of 1801. And there are 343 voters on that list, and 46 of them are women. So I was very excited, to say the least, and I vividly remember barging into Phil's office with this photocopied scan in my hand, probably jumping off the ground.
Yeah, you were about 3 feet off the ground. Yeah.
But really, it's because, you know, this wasn't just an exciting day for us at the museum. This is a really exciting discovery for women's history more generally. It's one of the first and most exponential pieces of evidence that we have that can actually speak to women voters in this earlier period.
So was there anything like this in other states? Or was New Jersey really the only early state to allow women and some people of color, those who were not enslaved, to vote?
New Jersey was the only state to explicitly allow or provide for women's vote. So while there was ambiguity in the 1776 Constitution, statutes adopted by the New Jersey legislature in 1790 and 97 said that the voters shall vote in the township where he or she resides. And we think that 1790 law is the first law to explicitly adopt the votes for women in the United States.
Hmm. All right. So Sarah Van Dyke, mm-hmm. this one of the women whose names appear on the poll list, why did you zero in on her?
So it's actually not just Sarah Van Dyke. It's the entire Van Dyke family. So okay. One of the things that we have begun to discover looking at these lists is that women were actually coming to the polls in groups, which is very telling for us for a multitude of reasons. But with the Van Dykes in particular, we don't just see Sarah Van Dyke. We see Anne, Catherine, and Rebecca Van Dyke and one of their friends, Jane Huntsman, along with them in a block that's showing up to the polls together. And after doing some genealogical research and really exploring the background of the Van Dykes, who were one of the founding families in Somerset County in New Jersey, we have actually learned that we believe that Rebecca Van Dyke, who was married to an infamous loyalist and also her first cousin during the Revolutionary War, John, who earned the moniker John the Tory Van Dyke, and they have 9 children. 5 of them are daughters, and 3 of those women actually appear alongside Rebecca on the poll list. So we actually have Rebecca Van Dyke voting with her daughters, Sarah, Anna, and Catherine Van
Amazing.
Dyke.
So why did women vote in a block? Why did they tend to go in groups?
That's a great question, and something that I think we've just really begun to explore. There are a lot of possible answers for this. The first is that, you know, we're looking at a very kind of contentious political partisan environment in this period. And many of these elections, although taverns and inns were not considered maybe legal polling places, we've begun to find that at least in most of the poll lists that we've identified, that most of these elections were taking place in taverns and other male-dominated spaces. So it's a possibility, perhaps, that maybe these women were showing up to the polls together in groups, either with family members or friends, as a way to, you know, have kind of strength in numbers or maybe combat any sort of negative or controversial comments mm-hmm. that might be swung their way.
Philip Mead, do we know if they voted alongside men, elbow to elbow, or was there some separation?
Well, voting occurred over 2 days. And we're talking about 300 people, 350 people in this case. So there's no separation formally between men and women voters. You see them alongside each other. You can actually tell when the clerk changes his pen or picks up and walks away for a while by the darkness of the ink. So you can kind of see the blocks that are coming in at a time. It's uncommon, it's less common for a woman to be voting alone than to be voting in a group. But typically she'll be voting alongside men as well. Typically she'll be voting with other women and with men at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting, too, that you can determine information from the brightness of ink.
Yeah. I mean, it's an impression.
It's fascinating.
I mean, the way these polls worked, this is all laid out in the statutes for voting. They had a box that was armored. It was 15-inch square. And it had 2 locks with bolts so that no one could deposit a ballot while the clerk and the judge were off taking a break somewhere. The poll lists that we have record the names of voters as they present themselves to vote. And then they deposit their ballot after they're deemed to be worth 50 pounds, et cetera. And then at the end, they open up the ballot box and they count the number of ballots against the number of names on the poll list. And if there's a discrepancy, they throw out a random selection of the ballots.
Really?
Yeah. So this is the best they can do. It's a nascent period of American Democratic behavior.
So, and this is from North to South Jersey. We find that women and some people of color are voting across the state. What were some of the issues that women influenced as they voted? Do you know in your research?
You know, that's actually a really great question, and one that quite a few people have asked me. And part of the issue with this is that, you know, we're not always sure. But what we do know and what we can glean from other primary sources in this period is that there weren't necessarily things in this period that we would maybe consider today to be, you know, quote unquote, women's issues. Women were just as involved in the community as men were. And a lot of the things that they cared about were things like, you know, infrastructure and basic things that were going to, you know, improve their community and improve their lives, whether economically, socially or culturally.
So what happened in 1807?
Well, basically hyper-partisanship, a deeply divided electorate. Newspapers had become, and the press had become, very, very bitterly partisan. There were efforts at some voter suppression through intimidation. There was a lot of claims of voter fraud. And those claims had traction because the electoral system was nascent, was in a state of what I call primordial ooze. They were still figuring out how to make democracy work. Mm. So there were a lot of irregularities. And as I mentioned, there's a constitutional provision that's reinforced in two statutes for a property requirement, which no one really can figure out how to implement because they're using an outmoded currency term and there's no documents to identify when someone's above or below it. So there's lots of opportunities for problems. And there were a series of high-profile controversial elections beginning in 1797 in Elizabethtown, New Jersey, what's now Elizabeth, and then again one in 1802 in Hunterdon County, and then in 1807 an election over where to put a courthouse between Newark and Elizabeth. And these divided people along party lines. The Republican Party had formed against the Federalist Party in the 1790s. Then in 1804, the Republican Party split between moderates and liberals. And in the midst of all of this, gradually all of these different sides begin scapegoating women, people of color, and what they called aliens, immigrants, as the source of all these electoral problems.
Do we know why they were scapegoated? Obviously, we're talking centuries ago. So is there information there that can indicate what happened?
Yes, there is information. But for us, this is something that I think that we're really still exploring now. This is, you know, a very complex sort of partisan environment. And in many cases, I think that these categories of people, it becomes easier just to exclude them than it does to find a way to include them. For women especially, and actually, I like to point to in 1807 with the contested election for the courthouse that Phil was just referring to. In those accusations of voter fraud surrounding that election, we do see reference to men that are voting as men and then putting on dresses and voting again as women. Hmm. So, you know, of course, naturally, the response to that is just to take the vote away from women in order to remedy that problem.
I mean, one of the big problems is that there are two categories of women and one of women and one of people of color that are definitionally assumed to have no property. Mm-hmm. For people of color, enslaved people are assumed to have no property, yeah. Although in fact they could in certain circumstances, but it's rare. And the other married women. So in this period, a common law principle called coverture held that a woman's property she brought into a marriage became her husband's. And so the these two categories became the target for this controversy over the ambiguities in the property law. How can so many women, how can so many people of color be voting when there are so many people in each of those groups who, by definition, have no property?
In your research for the exhibit, have you come across any published reaction from women who were stripped of the right to vote around 1807? Any articles, any letters? And if not, I'm assuming you're probably on the lookout. Mm-hmm. Marcella?
We are definitely on the lookout. Yeah. We have not yet been able to find any published account by a New Jersey woman specifically that is, you know, seemingly outraged in 1807 by, you know, losing the electorate. However, we do see in the 1790s and the early 1800s a developing what some historians have referred to as women's rights talk. We see this in publications like Mary Wollstonecraft's Vindication of the Rights of Women. We see it even in, you know, in The Nation with Judith Sargent Murray publishing On the Equality of the Sexes, actually even a year before Vindication comes out. We see Philadelphia playwright Susanna Rowson coming out on stage and making pretty blatant feminist claims. We see women that begin to open schools, women's schools and girls' academies to educate a new population of young girls.
So this really set the stage for the suffrage movement, which came, what, it really started picking up steam toward the end of the 19th century.
Absolutely. And that's part of the argument that we make actually throughout the exhibition, too, is that the later generation of suffragists in the 19th and 20th centuries are really standing on the shoulders of not only these early women voters in New Jersey, but this earlier period of women's activism.
So we only have 30 seconds left. Some quick highlights from the exhibit, which again opens in August. A letter from Abigail Adams to her husband, John Adams. Remember the ladies?
Yes, and that will actually, as far as we know, mark the first time that letter will return to Philadelphia since John Adams initially received it in 1776.
And what else? A couple quick other highlights?
Sure. Some of the poll lists will be on display. The dress of Deborah Sampson when she was married after she served as a soldier in the Revolutionary War. A tavern sign where people voted with Jefferson on it, showing the partisanship of election places. And suffrage objects from the later 19th century.
And it opens in August. Philip Mead, Chief Historian and Director of Curatorial Affairs at the Museum of the American Revolution, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Marcella Micucci is Curatorial Fellow at the Museum of the American Revolution. Great to have you with us as well.
Thanks so much.
Up next, what's happening to New Jersey State Government Twitter feed? Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. New Jersey has long been a national punchline. Even Ben Franklin is said to have weighed in, likening the state to a barrel tapped at both ends, losing the best of its beer to New York and Philadelphia. Well, New Jersey is flipping the script, thanks to two self-avowed Jersey girls who work in the governor's office managing the official state Twitter account at NJGov. It's fun, sassy, and off the hook, and it's gaining the Garden State some real attention and respect. Pearl Gable is digital director for the New Jersey governor's office, and she joins us now. Hi, Pearl.
Hello, Mary. Thanks for having us.
Sure. And Megan Coyne is digital assistant for the New Jersey governor's office. Great to have you with us as well.
Great to be here. Thank you, Mary.
Of course.
Yes.
A state government Twitter feed, it's probably not the place most of us turn to for pithy humor, but at NJGov started getting some real attention in December after someone posted, "Who let New Jersey have a Twitter?" You know, as a New Jerseyan myself, I kind of find that annoying. What was your reaction?
Your mom. You know, the natural reaction to that question.
It's probably the natural reaction most of us are thinking, but you actually put it out there. So what was the thought process?
Since Megan joined the team in June, and we started having really big conversations about expanding the voice of New Jersey, kind of like just being more real, kind of digging into ourselves for like that Jersey girl attitude. And that your mom tweet probably was like the culmination of like, you know, all those discussions. So, you know, we just were trying to keep it real and, like, dig in deep.
Well, Megan, you know, this is an official state government social media site, of course. Was there any hesitation about answering the way you did?
Yeah, I mean, so we happened to both be on the Twitter account at the same time, and we both saw this guy tweet that at the same exact moment. And we used to sit in cubicles right next to each other. So over the wall, I was just like, oh, my God, did you see that? Like, that's so rude. And Pearl was like, I know, like, I kind of want to respond your mom. And I mean, I just started hysterically laughing. So that's how we knew that it was a funny response. But then Pearl was like, you know, maybe something happened to this guy's mom. Maybe it's too mean. And then I was just kind of like, you know, your mom's like one of the most classic comebacks of all time. So we thought that it was okay, so we went ahead with it. But, you know, we balanced our Twitter account out. There's a lot of funny things on there, and then there's a lot of really important things on there. So we stand behind it.
Well, what was the reaction to your mom? lots of likes, lots of response.
It definitely started a movement.
Yes, we had like over 85,000 retweets of that one, I think. The governor loved it. For like the next couple of weeks, every time he saw us, he would just be like, your mom.
Were you a little nervous about that initially?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've had a couple times where Megan and I will be like, oh, it's nice working with you. We're gonna bomb the way. We're going to hit the return and send this tweet.
Might as well go out swinging, right? But it
didn't. We're going to go out swinging. We're going to keep it real. And that's it. That was one of those, for sure. It was like a really... really tough 30-second deliberation before we dropped that.
So when you got 85,000 retweets, I mean, what was the average retweet before that?
We would probably be really happy with like 50 or 100. Mm-hmm. Like that would be really great for us. So it was a biggie for sure.
So Megan Coyne, you know, since that happened in December, you guys have gotten a little bit bolder. Other states are not off limits. As best you can for radio, describe the tweet which says, might mess around and punk Delaware. what does that look like visually?
It was, so, you know, I had seen that, like, that meme, like, might mess around and on Twitter for a while, and I showed it to Pearl, and I was like, oh, I think we should use this on EdJacob, but I don't know what to write. And then she was like, punk Delaware, because, you know, we like to go back and forth with Delaware a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so then we kind of just went with it.
So how did Delaware respond?
Oh, I can't even remember at this point.
Well, nothing as pithy as the Jersey feed, I guess.
Yeah, it's tough to compete. I mean, Chicago just joined Twitter, and they swing back pretty hard. But I mean, admittedly, it's very hard to work in government and run social media feeds and be this ballsy. I mean, it's kind of because of this administration allowing us to do it. So it's hard to come back the way that we come back.
And it's hard to write humor too. It's tough to have things, you know, go out there and frankly not bomb, and your site seems to be rolling right along. What do each of you bring to the table? How are you alike in style or different? Megan?
I think that what we both bring to the table, most importantly, is that we're both born and bred Jersey girls. You know, we've both been here forever. Pearl worked in New York for a little bit, but she's, you know, raised in New Jersey, Jersey girl through and through. So that personality that we both bring to the table is probably, I think, the most important ingredient. That's why it feels so authentic. And, you know, there's like these universal New Jersey experiences that we both had and that we all have. And that's why the Twitter feels so real and relatable.
Pearl, what makes a Jersey girl?
You know, bold, brassy, big, kind of unafraid. We're in a really dense, competitive, diverse environment where you kind of have to like step up, you know, and I think that's what makes a Jersey girl. It's just being strong and being unafraid to speak your mind.
So speaking of big and being unafraid, you know, very, very few things, it looks like, are off limits in your feed, including Governor Murphy. A couple of weeks ago, you tweeted, quote, actual footage of @Gov Murphy getting ready to drop his 2021 budget address. Please describe the video and the hat. Megan? I mean, you really need to be able to see this to understand it, but I was dying when I saw it.
Well, it's a video of Billy Porter at the, what award ceremony was it, the Grammys?
I think it was the Grammys.
Yeah, at the Grammys with his amazing hat with beads that that electronically could open up and reveal the face.
Okay. So it's along the lines of getting ready to drop or revealing the budget. So, yeah, there was Billy Porter in his, you know, with his typical style with this amazing hat. You know, and of course, he's a stand-in for the governor in your tweet. So am I correct?
100% for sure. The governor saw that one. He appreciated it as well. I mean, because this guy, he's bold, and he's like, and it's revealing something, and it's kind of excited, and that's kind of the way that the governor kind of comes out onto the stage to reveal like his policies and stuff like that. So we kind of just made that parallel.
Yeah, he doesn't mind a bit of fun.
He loves fun.
He loves the fun.
He's extremely funny.
All right, yeah. So we do know that @NJGov entertains, but there is, as you alluded to earlier, an official mission, talk about state business and important information. And for instance, you recently tweeted information about the coronavirus. Tell us a little bit more about how you craft the more serious side of New Jersey state government business. Megan?
Yeah, so at the end of the day, it's a government account, and we use it to get the important information out there about, you know, the governor's initiatives and just important information for New Jerseyans to know. And we just kind of try to do it in a way that feels more digestible. You know, government and policy can be, I mean, just like a little bit boring, honestly, and like hard for everyday people to digest and to feel connected to. So we just try to, like, you know, explain it in like a fun and like simple way that really resonates with people. I don't know, Pearl, do you have any better way of explaining it?
No, I think that's pretty good. I mean, we're just really trying to like engage, inform, educate. And that's kind of the mission of the account and of Murphy account and of everything that we're doing in this whole digital sphere. And we're doing multimedia. We have a really small digital team. It's just me, Megan Coyne, and Edwin Torres, who's basically the governor's amazing photographer. And we're just doing the multimedia work and doing the writing and just trying to like get all the points across so that people can understand, like, turn policy into something digestible.
It sounds like you both landed in a dream job.
Yeah.
I mean, you go to work and you have fun.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a winding road, but something like this, like a this exact type of digital work, which takes everything from photography to video to writing to strategy, is for me a culmination of like a kind of scattered career, and it makes perfect sense here.
Let's get it,
which is amazing.
Let's talk a little bit about New Jersey itself for people who, you know, are kind of peripherally familiar with it, who don't live there. Jersey is, or seems like, you know, not one whole state, but two and maybe even three different states, north, south, central. Do you have a different approach to each? Megan?
No, I don't think that we view it that way. I mean, I want to say that we do believe that Central Jersey exists, which is very important. But I think that we see it as, you know, like one big, crazy New Jersey family, mm-hmm. and that there's things that people in all parts of the state relate to. And we try to, you know, reflect that on our account. And I think that we're doing a pretty good job of it. But
and by the way, John Bon Jovi apparently confirmed the existence of Central Jersey on your Twitter feed.
That's right. He did that. Edwin Torres got that on cell phone video, and we uploaded that ASAP. It was fantastic.
Other celebrities check in at all?
We got a big like from Bruce Springsteen's account.
Really?
Yeah. Megan was over the moon. And last night,
yeah, that
John
was a big
Oliver
moment.
A big moment. And last night, John Oliver called us out on Last Week Tonight. the TV show on HBO. We were pretty excited.
Do you actively go after celebrities?
I don't think so. Once in a while, we like tweet at like a New Jersey celebrity saying like hi. But for the most part, I think that we just try to, you know, talk to and relate to everyday New Jerseyans.
Yeah.
And everyday New Jerseyans love to respond to this feed and tweet. In scrolling through the feed, I'm seeing lots of really cool pictures of New Jersey. And beautiful pictures, too. You know, as a person, again, who lives in Jersey, there's just a lot of, you know, there is a lot of beauty. Perhaps, you know, so many people tend to think of the, you know, 13A and the Turnpike. So what are some of the pictures that are some of your favorites? Describe some of what you've seen.
Well, I'll just say just really quickly, we want to debunk the stereotype of New Jersey. I mean, we are the stereotype, but we're so much more than that. We are our weaknesses, but we also are the greatnesses. And it's our followers who are like tagging us in their amazing photos from all over New Jersey. Megan, I don't know. Do you have favorites? There's so many good ones.
I don't know if there's like, you know, a single photo in particular, but I mean, I think that something you see a lot on our account is photos of our beaches, especially like in the morning, sunrise or sunset. Yeah. I mean, those photos are just beautiful, and we're so proud of our beaches in New Jersey because we have the best beaches in the world, and those photos I think really capture that and help us highlight that.
Yeah.
All right, so a couple quick things that I've learned from your Twitter feed. For those who are not in the know, the official state meat is Taylor ham, which is actually
pork roll.
There's just a north-south divide with that, right?
Yes. You know what? Megan is from North Jersey. I'm from Central Jersey. We're very divided on that, and we will not agree on this at all.
And I've lived in South Jersey for decades. Somehow I've missed out on disco fries. What are those?
Oh, ooh. Wow. Those are a delicacy at diners. Yes. It's French fries covered in gravy and mozzarella cheese.
Mm-mm.
Then you can also add to, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely delicious. And one more thing. Gabagol is capicolo.
That is correct.
Took me a while to get the pronunciation of that. All right. So you came up with the state's profile picture. Baby Yoda holding the Garden State. What was that about?
You know, Megan, you know, we're a great collaboration. Megan's like identified as Generation Z. I kind of identify as an elder millennial. So she kind of shows me some memes. She showed me that meme that everybody was using. It's Baby Yoda. And it was cool. And then the next day I was driving into work and I was listening to a song by Miguel that had this lyric, Luke Skywalker on these haters. And I had this vision of the Baby Yoda with the New Jersey. I came in and Megan and I got on that very quickly and tweeted it out with that lyric.
What sort of response did you get?
Lovely.
I think people loved it. We saw a lot of our followers change their profile picture to be the same, that image too.
So good.
Are there other pieces of the state's social media which are following suit, or are you guys responsible for those as well?
I mean, we also run GovMurphy. And we're always trying to inflect his personality into that. And just always try. And I think the agencies are like having a lot more fun lately. Megan, what do you think?
It's catching on.
Yeah, we definitely try to make the governor's account, you know, reflect his personality as well. And like Pearl said, I think that the agencies are also starting to take on like a funnier, sharper tone.
Mm-hmm. Well, at NJGov is a hoot. And if you haven't checked it out, I highly recommend it. Megan Coyne, Pearl Gable, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary. Such a pleasure.
All right. And don't forget to join us on social media as well here at Radio Times. You'll find everything at whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for tuning in to Radio Times.